Let's see now. Today's parasha is called
Behar.
On the mount?
Yeah.
On Mount Sinai.
Yeah.
Now, Jeff, when the cloud came down,
yeah,
every time Moshe went up, wasn't there a blowing of the shofar?
Well, when he was called to come up, certainly on the day when God spoke the Decalogue, there was a blowing of the shofar.
So is Scripture silent that it wasn't every time that he was called up to the mount?
Right.
Okay.
Scripture silent. Now, let's see. Brett wanted me to be able to read this to you in Greek. So this is just for Brett. Kilthon kielthenis nazara uin tetra. Got that part?
Exactly.
Tetramenos. Now, you know what tetramenos is? Tetramenos. This is a place where Yeshua had been brought up. Nazara. Yeshua was brought up where?
Golgotha.
Close. No. That's where he was brought down.
Oh.
Nazareth.
You mean
brought up to Jerusalem? Nazareth.
We're talking about where he grew up as a child.
Oh.
Yeah.
Nazareth.
Right. So let's hear somebody turn to Luke 4.
Oh.
And 16 to 21 is what I want to read. And we're going to relate the idea. We're going to ask a couple questions like, did Yeshua ever declare himself Messiah? Or did he just wait for everybody to figure that out? And you know, there's whole fields in the New Testament, the scholarship, that say, oh, it was a secret and, you know, had to be figured out. And then there are others say, well, you mean he came and he never declared that he was Messiah? How would anybody would know? They just see it by his deeds? Or what kind of deeds? So we're trying to figure out right now whether there's an answer to that question. And who wants to read Luke 4? 16, okay.
Anna? 16 to 21.
16 to 21.
He went to Nazareth where he had been brought up, and on the Sabbath day he went into the synagogue, as was his custom.
He had a custom? What was the custom?
Going into the synagogue.
Going to synagogue. Okay.
And he stood up to read.
He stood to read?
Must have been Shabbat.
The scroll of the prophet Isaiah was handed to him. Unrolling it, he found the place where it is written, "The Spirit of the Lord is on me, because he has anointed me to preach good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim freedom for the prisoners and recovery of sight for the blind, to release the oppressed, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor."
Stop. Now, I know you want to read verse 20 and 21, but I'm going to interrupt you for a second. I want somebody, meanwhile, to turn to Isaiah 61, and I want to hear what verse 1 says and what verse 2 says. Except you never know, I might stop you in between. And if you're looking for closure, just remember this. Yeshua hasn't come back yet.
The Spirit of the Lord God is upon me, because the Lord has anointed me. He has sent me to bring good news to the humble, to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to captives and release to those in prison, to proclaim a year of the Lord's favor.
Stop. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What verse are you on?
One.
Two.
Oh, to proclaim a year of the Lord's favor. Start at verse two.
Oh, you mean you started verse two?
Started it.
Okay, well, finish verse 2. I can't believe you stopped in the middle. How could you do that?
In a day of vengeance of our God.
In a what?
A day of the vengeance of our God.
A day of vengeance? I bet that's something that we could translate into Hebrew. Anna, how would you translate day of vengeance? Just off the top of your head.
Yom HaNakam.
Yom HaNakam. Nakam. You know that word, Nakam.
Yes. Don't look at me like that. You're scaring me.
Day. That word is
Yom
in
is
Hazinu.
Day.
Yom is day. And Nakam, it's in Hazinu?
Yes.
Wow, it's in Hazinu, Nakam?
Uh-oh.
Sounds familiar.
Sounds familiar. What verse? 42, 43? Where is this found? In Hazinu.
Okay. Nakam, come.
When Nakam Yashiv Letzara. V'chiper admato amo.
I'll make drunk my arrows with blood.
Yeah, I'll make drunk my arrows from blood. Then what?
My sword shall devour flesh.
My sword devours flesh.
Blood of slain and captives.
Blood of slain and captives.
The heads of the enemy princes.
The heads of the enemy princes. That's verse 42. And then 43.
Rejoice with him, you heavens. Bow down, all you gods, before him. For he will avenge the blood of his sons.
He will what?
Avenge the blood of his sons.
Ah, v'nakam. Now, he will avenge the blood of his sons. Now, when we were doing it, v'nakam yashiv letzara, and vengeance he will take upon his enemies. But here we're saying, v'dam avadav, no, v'dam banav. Because, see, she's reading right now from the English translation, the New English Bible. The New English Bible is picking up on the Masoretic text? No.
No.
On the Septuagint? Yeah. Which is an older witness. And on another older witness, Qumran. And Qumran and the Septuagint are two different worlds, believe me. And yet they have the same witness in reading vengeance. He will... Well, here's the blood of the Dam and Nav Yikom. So this is the blood of his sons. He will avenge. Okay? V'nakam, and vengeance, he will return upon what? Read it for us. Read it
for us. For he will avenge the blood of his sons and take vengeance on his adversaries.
Here's the, he take vengeance upon his... V'nakam, yashiv, letzarah. But now she's got a couple other ones stuck in here. This is, again, reading from the Septuagint. And from Qumran. Go ahead.
He will punish those who hate him and
punish
make
those that hate him
and make expiation for his people's land.
Bechiper admato. Right, you got to finish it, don't you? And he'll atone for the land of his people. Okay. And how does he atone for the land of his people? By covering innocent blood with
his lamb.
Jesus. And by slaying.
Sure.
The bad guys.
The bad dudes.
So it's bad guys. It's bad guys' blood that's going to cover a good guy's blood. It's payback. And that's...
Is it going to be just life for life?
Vindication. That's godly vindication. Sometimes, you know, when we translate a vengeance, you know, we read into it all this other stuff. Clan warfare, payback, as in, I hate you, so I'm going to get you 10 times what you did to me. If he has like that, and then we say, well, God doesn't do that. But here... It's Hazinu, and it's like, well, at some point there's justice, and justice says you sow, so shall you reap, and if you've been covering the land with killing everybody, then maybe you're going to pay for that to cleanse the land. Because when you kill everybody, what happens to the ground?
It's defiled.
It defiles the ground. And everybody that's innocent, that's living on the ground, is living on what?
Defiled
ground, because you what?
Killed
a bunch of people. And if you kill a bunch of people, should we just, you know, grant you grace and let you, you know, go on with no...
No.
Well, why not? I mean, we're living in the age of grace and, you know, turn the other cheek. Why not?
God's a holy God.
Well, God's a holy God, but, you know, what's that got to do with, you know, some guy that killed somebody else? I mean,
the land is his, you said earlier.
Oh, the land is his. We did say that. So, wait a minute. We've been, like, putting... innocent blood on his land and defiling it.
Mm-hmm.
And then we've got a problem.
Mm-hmm.
Alright, now this has been happening through the history of Israel. Now the Romans are in there and they're beating everybody. They're killing everybody. Okay? And Yeshua, why does he have to come at this time? We're going to deal with the covenant real quickly and then we'll come back to some of this reading. Because the covenant is so important for the background. The covenant... What was the covenant? What is the covenant?
Abraham.
One of the great things about the covenant is if you act morally, you get the rain you need. If you act morally on the land, God will let it rain and it will grow all kinds of fruit. In fact, it will turn into a garden of delight, paradise. We'll get all the rain we need. Israel's a rain-fed land and it depends on faith in order to get the rain it needs. And during the count of the Omer, that's what we're sweating. Is he going to send the rain? Right now, when we need it, to put a head on the wheat crop, when we need it, so that we get a lot of wheat instead of a little wheat. And if you don't get a little rain right now, no big head on the wheat crop, and then the wheat crop doesn't have a bushy head. If it doesn't have a bushy head, what does it look like?
Puny.
And then we reap, and all year, we pay for it. With a puny crop. So right now, if we get a little rain, it's like billions floating from heaven down to our granaries. And if we don't get it, you eat it all year, chump. Or you don't eat it, because it isn't there. So we're sweating right now. We want just the right balance. And you know, it's tricky, because if we get just solid rain, that's good for the barley and the wheat, puts a big head on the crop. But there's the other five of the Sheva Minim. Sheva, seven. Minim, species. The seven species of fruits that grow in the Promised Land. We've got the grapes and the olives. It's God fruits. Can you say God fruits?
God
fruits. God fruits. So dates. G is grapes. O is olives. D
dates.
Is dates.
Figs.
F is figs.
Raisins.
Pomegranates.
PhD? No, PHO. Pomegranates. Pomegranates. And fruit, you spell it P-H-R-U-I-T, right? Fruit. Fruit. So we got God, fruits, grapes, olives, dates, figs, and?
Pomegranates.
You can't say a P. I don't want a P. I want pomegranates. If you press your lips together, you're out. Now say it without pressing your lips together. Did you touch your lips together, Jennifer? Try it again. She did it. Jennifer's turned Jewish. She could not pronounce a fake. Pay fake. Okay. So God fruits includes grapes, olives, dates, figs, and pomegranates. Okay. With the pomegranates, that's seven. And the grapes, and the olives, the dates, the figs, and the pomegranates, how do you think they become multiplied?
Rain.
No, rain kills them. Why do you think rain kills them? What do you need in order to do anything for these things?
You got sunshine on them,
yeah?
Yeah, it's fine.
And then what happens? So here it is, the buds are putting out, and then there's the little, you know, olive plant, and there's the little date plant.
You got to prune them.
You got to prune them, okay, you prune them, but then what?
Love them.
Cultivate
them, and then what happens? Yeah, nobody knows. How do you like that? You don't farm.
No.
None of you are farmers.
No.
You know, we were out, Pat and I were out walking around in the woods today. We saw a bunch of people walking around. They looked like they were Martians. Well, on a closer look, we found out they weren't Martians. They were Americans. But they had white suits on. And then we decided maybe they were astronauts.
Oh, you mean spray.
Well, kind of like that. They had these helmets on and white, and they were completely insulated.
Beekeepers.
They were beekeepers. Well, these were high school students that were on a field trip, but they were coming to visit the bee farms. And they had them all decked out, and these guys were walking around in Martian suits looking for bees, right? And then they found these big white things where the bees were, and then they were walking around there having a good time, right?
Shouldn't they be looking for A's?
Oakland A's. So what do you suppose the bees do at this time?
Well, they pollinate.
But you know, those dates aren't going anywhere without pollination.
Figs, too. And there's a big loss of bees in this country.
Big loss of bees is a problem. But in Israel, they didn't have to worry about that. He said, you got a nice place out there. You got nothing but honey?
Milk and honey. Yeah, right.
What does that mean? That means the cows are grazing out there and the bees are buzzing.
I'm going to ask you a question.
Milk and honey was cows out there.
And bees.
Cows and bees.
Yeah, that's what you mean.
No.
Five fruits.
Five fruits.
You didn't...
Like grapes? You don't think the grapes need pollination?
No, you only said five.
Wheat and barley.
Yeah.
So the rain is good for the wheat and the barley, but the rain is no good for the ones that require pollination. Because too much rain, what does it do to pollination?
Kill it.
It puts it all on the ground, it doesn't go anywhere, and nothing gets pollinated. So You got this interesting time when you're counting the Omer, because while you're ascending, and you're sitting there ascending, as we know from the previous Bible study here, while you're ascending, the rain is falling, and you're wondering what's going to happen, and if you get too much rain, it's going to hurt the other five. But if you get too little rain, it's going to hurt the bread crops, the wheat and the barley. So you need just the balance. The Spirit's got to be in there so that you get rain, but you get wind, so that you get this combination, and it's kind of a hula dance. They say, give me a little rain. Okay, give me a little pollination. Hey, give me a little beach. And you got to get dry the place out to get a lot of pollination. You got to rain and get to the head of the wheat crop, and you got to get back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And it's all while you're counting the Omer. If you get too much rain, and you get too little rain, and either way, you got a problem. No fruitfulness in the land. So, it's really spirit-led. Ruach HaKodesh, the holy wind. And they're sitting there asking God for rain. They're asking God for the wind. At the same time, living water and wind. Now, we're counting the Omer. This is going on, all right? And the covenant says, well, you know, if you guys are acting right, you'll get the rains that you need. You get the balance. So the land will be fruitful. So, you got an A on your moral report card for Torah obedience. And you're going to get an A on your agricultural farming card. And they go hand in glove. And you don't control it by the way the Canaanites, where they go cut their sons up and feed them to the deity, and where they go to the shrine over there, where they pollinate one another right on the altars. That's called the fertility cults. And then say, hey, nature, you know, copy us so that we can have a proliferation here. And they got both of those things going, and God's out there saying, cut down the all Asherah poles and kill all the foreign gods. And don't do it their way, because magic isn't the way it works. The way it works is obedience to Torah, and the covenant will take care of it. But if you're not obedient, then I'm going to shut up the heaven like bricks, and you'll perish off the good land the Lord has given you. So what do you know? Every year, we leave Egypt where we had the rain because we had a river. And if it rained anywhere in Africa, the river went by Egypt, and we had the Nile and the Delta, and it's always going to come in because we've got all of Africa's rain coming down the mountains to the Nile, and it's sweeping by, and we've got the entire security of the rainfall of the entire continent of Africa going for us. Except God says in the days when the Torah is going to be filled full with meaning, Sukkot, that the nations that don't go up to Jerusalem to worship God won't get rain. And he says, Egypt even, this is Zechariah 14, 16 to 21, prophets, outstanding prophecies relating to Torah, Egypt won't get rain either. It'll dry the Nile up. So Israel is rain-fed. It comes down from heaven. Man doesn't live by bread alone, because he lives by faith, and faith and moral Torah obedience will bring down prosperity, because God will bless from generation to generation across time when you're living in faith on the land. But you've left Egypt, where you have the security of the Nile, to come into a place that's rain-fed, and every year you get a report card and you find out how you're doing. Current accounts. You didn't do too well this year. No head on the wheat crop. Bald! I said, no! Don't worry. A year will go by, so you don't have any bread for a while. You'll be fine. By next year, you'll be in a better shape to try and do better. This is what was going on. And we'd be looking at the Canaanites, and they're doing fertility cults, and they're getting rain, and we're not, and we're going, what's going on around here? Let's try the fertility cults. Anything. Right? Like a Christian going to a seance. Same thing. Get some direction, because, you know, they want to hear. Got to have some direction. It happens, right? So, we know from Hazina, when you do that, God says, oh, you're whoring after foreign gods, I'll clobber it. No problem. So we get it, right? So the covenant is demanding things. Now the covenant ratchets up, and I want to read, and then I'll come back to these other readings. I want somebody to turn to Leviticus 25, and we're going to read a couple of verses here from them that are going to give you an idea how the covenant works. The covenant affects people that are living on the land, okay? I don't think that's going away. In fact, Israel's back in the land now. When you're in land, the covenant's operating on land. You've got to deal with it. It can go away. Read the verses in Leviticus 25. Somebody read verse 14.
25 and 14.
Leviticus 25, verse 14.
If you sell anything to your neighbor or buy anything from him, either of you is to exploit the other.
Now, when morality is breaking down and people aren't, you know, paying attention to Torah, they start jigging the scales around and they don't give honest weights and measure. It's like a guy that keeps the spare change. You know, if you're a father and you got a son and you give him a $10 bill and he goes out and he comes back, he doesn't bring you the change, don't ignore it. That's what this is about. Say, hey, where's my change? You know, I didn't give you the $10. I gave you night out on the town, but I want the change. Well, Dad, there was only 38 cents. I didn't think you'd be that stingy. What are you going to do to that guy?
You gotta give it to the other side. Take away from him who doesn't have even less than he has the most gift.
Yeah, you say, well, give me that 38 cents because I'm much stingier than that. I'm going to take that away from you and I'm going to give it to your brother there. And I hope he, you know, does better with it than you do, but we'll see. And next time, remember, I want my change back because I give freely, but I don't expect you to steal.
And you get that from verse 14?
Yeah, how do you like that?
No.
No. Well, this is in reverse. See, this is God taking back the spirit change. See, you got movable property here. And see, when you're not keeping the covenant, the first thing he does is he takes away movable property to get your attention. You know, when you want to get a mule's attention, you hit him with a 2x4. Get it?
You got to be careful where.
Right between the eyes. You don't want to hit him in the eye. You want to hit him between the eyes.
You could also set up like a pole with food in a bucket.
Yeah.
And you'd strap it to him and you'd put it right in front of him, but he could never reach it.
That's the carrot approach. No, you don't want a carrot right now. Here, this is a 2x4. This is after the guy did something you didn't like.
Finally, when he does what you want, you give him a
little. Oh, I see. Give him a little.
Well, you can't give it to him all of his time, but won't do anything anymore.
How do you like that? Well, here's the thing on the covenant. He says in verses 1 to 12, 1 to 13, I'm going to bless you in the following ways.
Right.
But if you don't, then I'm going to curse you in the following ways. And the curse really means a removal of blessing. The word kalal, haklala, is a pulling away of glory. It's a removing. It's because now instead of being heavy, I'm going to be light with honor. And you know what happens when you treat somebody lightly that's honorable? Like, what if you walked up to the President of the United States and you said, hey man, how you doing? Give me a high five. What if you said that to George Bush? During, you know, everybody's in a tie and you walk up and say, hey man, give me a high five. Not appropriate? Why not? I mean, you're being friendly to the guy. Aren't you being friendly?
Too friendly.
Too friendly? See, you treat him lightly. When you treat him lightly, that's a removal of blessing. It's treat lightly. So we're dealing with curse. It's God is removing his presence. When he removes his presence, the status quo begins to fold up a little, like a little less blessing. You treat him lightly, he treats you lightly. So now you're not getting quite what you're used to. What have you done for me lately, God? And he says, less. Did I get your attention yet? So read verses 25 to 28.
25 says, that is, if one of you becomes poor and sells some of his property, his next of kin can come and buy back what his relative sold. If the seller has no one to redeem it, but becomes rich enough to redeem it himself, he will calculate the number of years the land was sold for, refund the excess to his buyer, and return to his property. If he hasn't sufficient means to get it back himself, then what he sold will remain in the hands of the buyer until the year of Yovel. In Yovel, the buyer will vacate it, and the seller return to his property.
Now, I got to understand a few things operating here. You got a Shemitah, which is release, sabbatical year. And on that year, debtors go free. So you got a slave, he goes free. Shemitah. And on top of that, you proclaim who owns the land anyway?
God.
God. So then you don't rape the land. You don't overwork the land. You don't sow, you don't reap. Because it's sabbatical, and on Shabbat, you don't sow and you don't reap. Because you don't do malacha, ordinary tasks. So if you're not doing ordinary tasks, you're not going to sow, you're not going to reap. If you're not going to sow and you're not going to reap, then where's the crop going to come from? And the answer is, well, from the ground, where it always comes from. You say, but I'm not doing anything. They say, that's right, you're living on faith, aren't you? Well, yeah, I'm living on faith, but, you know, I'm going to starve. Well, that's not what the Torah says. See, well, you try it. I don't want to do that. I said, well, I know it's tough out there. But, you know, what's God asking you to do? Just observe the principle that it's his land and he doesn't want you to work it to death. And he doesn't want you playing Pharaoh on year 7 over his land. And what do you think you are anyway? You're chattel in his house. Chattel? Me? Yeah, you're redeemed. Mm-hmm. Redeemed from where? Paro. Who's Paro? Big house. And what kind of big house was that? That guy was a brute. That guy said, you don't like it? I'll take the straw away, make the same rations. You don't like it? I'll break your back. You got out of there, right? You're my house now. In my house, you don't work on Shabbat. I don't like that, God. I don't have any security. You don't have security? What are you, crazy? Who redeemed you? Yeah, but I don't trust you to, you know, feed me on Shabbat when I'm not working. Well, then you got a problem with the covenant. You're going to treat the covenant lightly? You're going to have something to worry about. I'm pulling out a little bit. My glory is not going to pervade the place so much. It's going to get a little hungrier for you, a little leaner. You don't trust me? Then I'll leave you alone. You fix it yourself. And that's how we get into the spiral. The spiral... We don't work, then it gets tougher. We got to work harder. Now we're supporting ourselves. Now God feels less wanted, so he pulls out some more. Now we're working harder, and we're on the spiral on the way back to Egypt to where we're, you know, going to be in trouble if we can't provide for ourselves. And God says, well, go alone. If you want to go alone, go alone. You want to kick me out, I'll leave. Live and let live. So we're going, okay, well, wait a minute. What's the deal here? Well, you got to count down to the Yovel. Yovel's homebringing. What happens at homebringing? Every man to his clan, every clan to its land. Mm-hmm. Every clan to its land? Yeah. Menashe lives here. Judah lives here. Everybody got their area. And inside the towns, this house here, you know, this is Caleb's area, and this is Kiriath Arba, where Caleb has got. And over here is Judah. And everybody goes to where they are. Here's Heshbon's allotments within Judah, and so on.
Isn't it inside the walls? It's 1 year.
That's another term,
except for the Levites?
Yeah, well, inside the walls, you're dealing with commercial property. And if commercial property is sold for a year and it's not redeemed, it's gone. So that was business.
Except for the Levites.
Outside the walled cities, then you got farmlands, and those you got after 2 years, you can still redeem it. But that's different because it's not commercial now, that's agricultural, yeah. And that's farmers. And it's not defended with an army, and it's not a city that's walled, and so on. But so there's different rules for different places. The urban is one thing, the suburb is another. But it's all under the covenant, and the terms are according to faith that's required.
Right.
Yeah. Now, here what we got is, you got God, every 7th year he weighs in and says, it's my land, don't work it. And every 50th year, every clan to its land. And every man to his clan. So people go free and go home. And we start over. And if you got some property that somebody improved, you know, Trump came down to New York City and he built the Trump Plaza. And year 50 comes along, he loses it, and it's back in your family. And you just inherited the Trump Plaza. Trump says, wait a minute, I wouldn't have built that if I'd have known a Jubilee year was coming. You say, who's counting? Right? You tell Trump, who's counting?
But was that part of the problem? After a while, they did start counting? And they kind of figured out different...
No, because that's fine too. That gives you a balance between communism, pure communism, where everybody's equal, which is what happens on the Jubilee year, and capitalism, which is what happens the day after. The day after, I got 50 years, and I'm going to grab everything I can. But if I had this fleeting dream that I want to own all of Israel, I bet I could buy the whole thing one day before the Jubilee year. Land would be going for a penny an acre, and I'd go out there and buy it all. It would cost me a fortune, and I'd own the whole thing for a day. I'd go, hey, I own Israel the next day. Hey, I gave it all to everybody. So that's your capitalism and communism dialectic playing out. And that's written into the Torah. It's just that we didn't keep it too well. But it's there.
We didn't keep it at all.
Well, yeah, that's right. We did a horrible job. And what do you know? We spent all our life getting kicked around the nations. Everybody owns everything except us. We own nothing. We say, oh, I don't have a nation. Oh, 2,000 years with no nation. No problem. You didn't keep the Jubilee. Run around for a while and have no property.
Is there any accounting?
That's what the spiritual descent back to Egypt is about.
Is there any accounting at all that they must have kept the first couple of Jubilees, right?
They as we, remember that.
All right, so we must have kept the first couple of Jubilees.
The only time we did it was the first...
When did it start deteriorating? Is there any accounting?
Yeah, we only kept it once.
That's it?
Yeah, after the first exile. After the first exile, we started going back and we said, that's it.
I mean, so we lost trust after the first...
We lost trust.
We figured it can't grow that much.
We got hammered in foreign lands, but let me get there and I'll come back. In other words, we learn the hard way by experience. And God says, do it. And we say, yeah, that's theory. And then we don't do it. And then it happens to us. We get the negative consequence. And after the negative consequence, we figure out a few things. Like, remember after the golden calf, we start spelling God's name G-D. Because we don't want to take his name in vain anymore. And we're still hung up over that, right? We still spell G-D.
Yeah, that's because they saw people go by the sword.
Yeah, it was tough on, well, the golden calf and everything else. It was tough. We took the name Lord's name in vain, and he said, don't do that at Sinai, and we did it. And then, after that, we got careful on that. Well, when we learn the hard way, we remember things. So let's read verse 29 to 31 now. What we're going to be dealing with now is this loss of property and the covenant when it spirals. And understand that the covenant takes couple thousand years to play out, and there's periods when it's like down and then up, and down and then up. In other words, there's always going to be blessing followed by another loss, followed by another prosperity, followed by another loss, but it's going in this inexorable path down because we're not observing the covenant. And so God's saying, look, I tried the carrot, I put you into Israel, I knocked off Pharaoh, I brought you in the wilderness, I fed you manna, I took perfect care of you, you didn't have to work for a living, nothing, you're spoon-fed, you never had to fight, nothing. And what do you do about it? You grumble, you're mad at me, you say, what have I done for you lately? And then what? The carrot's not working, I start giving you the covenant, you want to earn it yourself, I tell you how to work the land, I tell you when not to work the land, I tell you what obedience is, what not obedience is, and you start doing it the hard way. I start measure for measure very carefully, I start trying the stick since the carrot didn't work. You don't chase the stick the way that donkey does, you don't chase the carrot the way that donkey does. I put it in front of you, you run halfway to the promised land, you go, yeah, and you start rebelling and you want to go back to Egypt. Now with the stick, I hit you a little bit, you move a little less. I hit you harder, you move a little less. I hit you really hard, you move a little less. You don't respond to the carrot, you don't respond to the stick. I don't understand. I'm God, I freed you from Pharaoh's house, you never had it so good. Your response is, give me the raspberry all the time. So I wrote it out in the covenant what I was going to do, and I've been so patient for thousands of years I measured out. So here I'm measuring out to you, 29 to 31, we're dealing with one of the bad things that happens after you continue to run after foreign gods rather than God, when you continue to just hold the Torah in contempt.
If someone sells a dwelling in a walled city, he has 1 year after the date of sale in which to redeem it. For a full year, he will have the right of redemption. But if he has not redeemed the dwelling in the walled city within the year, then title and perpetuity passes to the buyer throughout all his generations. It will not revert in the Yovel. However, houses and villages not surrounded by walls...
Wait a minute, did you go past 31?
No, he's reading 31.
Okay, that's fine.
However, houses and villages not surrounded by walls are to be dealt with like the fields in the countryside. It may be redeemed before the Yovel, and they revert in the Yovel.
So businesses and commercial land, like in the walled cities, you got a year to get them back. Family can go get them and buy them back. Otherwise, gone. And you don't get it back, gone. But if you're out in the plains and the countryside,
where the clans were living and are living with the agriculture that was set up in the first place, then that'll revert. You got 2 years after that, 2 years warning, you can go and get it back. If you go and get it back, it stays in the family. But irrespective, if the Jubilee comes, you get it back anyway. So businesses you lose, but homesteads you get back. And in the Yovel, in the home bringing time at the year 50, whenever it runs its course, that guy cashes in. He gets back the clan inheritance. And so at that point, it's like every man to his clan and every clan to his land. And we restore. And if it's been improved, you get it back with the improvements because you can't take it with you. That's the way it goes. So you can improve, you can grow wealth, but in year 50, everybody's even again. And then you start a new cycle. Now that's the idea of the Yovel. So the idea of the Shemitah, release debtors, release slaves, and let the land be released from work too. Jubilee, restore everybody's inheritance. Everybody go home, regroup, start over, everybody's equal.
Question.
Yes.
Will the day one, or year one start at the beginning of the millennium?
Well, probably. I mean, what happened right now is after the first, when we went into diaspora the first time, lost the first temple, we knew 50 years from then was going to be Jubilee. Because we just lost everything. So that's when we started dating. Before that, it was like, it's theory, you know. Maybe we'll do it one day. Then when we lost everything, we said, you know something? There's something to this. So then we started counting. And so it's around 38 or 33, something like that, from 538 down to the present. And it goes back to the first diaspora, 586.
When's the next time going to be there? The next cycle, so to speak, of that?
Well, I don't know, 586, 587, and then 537, something like that. After 537, you'd be on the other side, it'd be like 17, 13, 63. The 13s and the 63s. 15s and 65, something like that. In that range is when the Jubilee is.
I'm interested. 2015.
The 15s. That's a guess, but I think that's where it is. So, anyhow, because we're using Caesar calendar and calendar. So, all right, so the idea here is you can lose movable property, you can lose your house, all right? How about verse 36? We're going to deal with death.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Why does he do a differentiation between the...
business and the house?
Yeah.
It's not so bad to lose your spare change, and it's not so bad to lose your business. It's a lot worse to lose ancestral
land. It's not business. It's a house in the city.
Yeah, but in the city, how do you think you got that? That's a walled city.
It's a walled city.
That's commerce. That's a city. You moved to the city.
So it's protected.
And then you opened up shop on the street, and you got a paid army around there protecting it. And you're in a corporation, and you're on Commerce City. And you're making money in the city.
So you can
and it's urban life.
Yeah, okay.
Urban life's different than your clan inheritance. Clans didn't inherit cities to start with. The only cities that were out there were the cities of refuge. And see, those are going
right.
to go to the Levites.
Right.
And
right.
that's never
going
right. to be lost. That's
right.
going to be called Geulat Olam.
Right.
Perpetual
right.
redemption.
Right.
So now we're going to the next one. This is verse 36. We're dealing with debt here. Now I want you to see that it's measured. And it keeps getting closer to home. When you got the penalty, when you got the curse, when the thing is coming down on you. And I want you to see that it's measured and it adds up over time. It's just that it takes God, 50, 100, 500 years to measure something out. And meanwhile, we're not keeping track with the Torah, so it's all under the radar for us. But that doesn't matter. We're looking back on 2,000 years and he's been careful about this. So verse 36.
You must ask verse 35? 36.
You can go 35.
If a member of your people has become poor, so that he cannot support himself among you. You are to assist him as you would a foreigner or a temporary resident, so that he can continue living with you. Do not charge him interest or otherwise profit from him, but fear your God, so that your brother can continue living with you.
So see, even if you dislike this guy, and even if the guy is a bag lady, treat him the way you treat a resident alien. It's like, don't just have contempt for him and ignore him. So his status is diminished in your eyes. Still have the same regard for him as you would have for some guy living down the street
who's on your block too. It's still your block. And on top of that, he's a member of your household. Remember that. So, look what's happening. I mean, you're not just taking it out of your wallet and handing the kid and saying, you know, give me back my spare change anymore. But you're lending them money without interest. And
you're feeding someone.
You're feeding them, and you're taking care of his debt problem.
Yep.
And at that point, maybe, you know, they're going to get his attention again. But if you don't get his attention, then we go on to verse 39. And here's going from personhood to servanthood.
If a member of your people has become poor among you and sells himself to you, do not make him do the work of a slave. Verse 40.
Well, it's good enough to stop there. So here, you've lost your personhood now. Now notice, first you lost your spare change, then you lost your business, then you lost your house, then you lost your lands, now you're in debt, and now you're not only in debt, you sold yourself. I mean, it's getting worse. This is the spiral. You're on the spiritual dynamic of going back to Egypt. You're going to be in big house with Mr. P himself. Par-O. That's with a capital O, right? He gives you nothing except straw. And then he takes that away. And then he beats you. Then he puts your own people over you to beat you. And he increases your rations so that you won't have any more people because you've been multiplying, and he doesn't like that either. And then when you're really miserable and you're crying out to God, what do you think happens? The answer is you're probably not crying out to God yet, even after you sold yourself. So instead of selling yourself to one of your friends or one of your landsmen, you know, the Jews, landsmen, then you got to go sell yourself to the foreigners. How about verse 47?
The foreigner living with you has grown rich, and a member of your people has become poor, and sells himself to this foreigner living with you, or to a member of the foreigner's family. He may be redeemed after he has been sold. Now his brothers may redeem him.
Now look what's happened to you. You're still living in the land of Israel, except the foreigners are getting prospered. You guys are out the window. Your family's out the window. Your people are selling themselves left and right into bondage. And now they can't even sell themselves to one of their landsmen because nobody could buy them anyway. So they've got to sell themselves to a Roman or an Egyptian, you know, whoever's, you know, making a bundle around there. But it's non-Jew. This is the covenant. You understand you're setting up Egypt right here in front of your face. Remember day 9 in Egypt, we wanted to go on a 3-day festival to the Lord, and Pharaoh wouldn't let us out of town. So he had it in downtown Egypt. The lights went out 3 days. No one could move. Creepy darkness. Everybody wiped out. It's a disaster. Happens right in your face, right where you are. You don't have to go there. It's here. The dynamic happens right before your eyes. You with me? You don't have to go back to Egypt. Egypt's here. In fact, you just sold yourself to an Egyptian here, and you're in his house. And he says, by the way, clean out Ray, the god of the sunshine. Clean out Ray's storage cabinet there. And I want you to prostrate yourself, coming and going from there, because it's polite to Ray. And you've got to respect my god when you're in my house. Okay? So you're in downtown Egypt, right in the promised land. That's verse 47. Now, what do you think about that? You need a kinsman redeemer after that, don't you?
Big time.
Meanwhile, all your kinsman redeemer are busted. They're poor. They're in the poorhouse like you. You know, it takes you about 1,500 years from the times of Moses until the Romans have taken over, and you're sitting there in Palestine, because they renamed it after the Philistines. And they're busy trying to hang their eagle in your temple. And you're poor. And they're paying, you know, your relatives to go out there and be tax gatherers. And they got their gods everywhere. And they worship on Sunday in the arenas. And you're supposed to be polite and publicly go along with all this while you're living in your own promised land. That's when you send the Messiah, you understand? That's when the kinsman redeemer comes. That's when the national goel is going to show up. He doesn't show up until then because you've got options under the covenant. First, your options are you. After that, it's your kinsmen. Your kinsmen redeemers and the family. And then your kinsmen redeemers and the clan. You don't have the kinsman redeemer for the nation until you're in downtown Egypt. Get it? You get a clear picture of the covenant? So, no wonder the Messiah is born in bondage. Unrecognized as a king. Under Roman yoke. With Caesar trying to kill him before he's born, or after he's born, or during his birth. During the census. You get it? It's a covenant. It's time to send the kinsman redeemer. So he sends the redeemer. So, here it is. The redeemer comes out of where? You don't want him coming out of Nazareth. Can any good thing come out of Nazareth? No! And what do you want, by the way? You want revenge against the Romans because they're beating the hell out of you, right? You want revenge. Nakam! We want Nakam! Now! Nakam! No, she doesn't like Nakam. Well, remember, Nakam, God's idea of Nakam is vindication, and it's defensive vindication. On the other hand, we're not even going to get that, it turns out. Let's go back and read Isaiah 61, 1 and 2. We're going to just read two verses from that, and then we're going to go pick up on Luke, because the Messiah, is the kinsman redeemer, is going to come into downtown Nazareth, where a prophet's without respect in his own hometown. And he's going to send the kinsman redeemer to his hometown. And that's what's going to happen here. So, go ahead. Pick up. Here comes Isaiah 61, 1 and 2.
The Spirit of the Lord God is upon me because the Lord has anointed me. He has sent me to bring good news to the humble, to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to captives and relief to those in prison, to proclaim a year of the Lord's favor and a day of the vengeance of our God, to comfort all who mourn.
He's going to comfort the mourners of Zion with the day of vengeance. Now understand something. Isaiah 61:1, it's got a lot of good news. The word release is in there all over the place. Release of prisoners, release, people can't open their eyes. You got guys coming out of the dungeons and they can't see. He's going to open their eyes. Release, release. And then the year of favor. Not the day of favor. The year of favor. The day of vengeance. The year of favor, the day of vengeance. Remember, it takes longer than long and then faster than fast. The day of vengeance is going to be so fast, don't blink, you'll miss it. Remember, you don't want to be ready for it anyway, because ready for it like I'm going to finally, you know, get a fix, it doesn't work that way. If you think you're going to get a fix, he's not going to do it. This is God out there, and he doesn't want you to get a fix. And if you're living for vengeance, he's trying to tell you, love your neighbors yourself. And don't expect to get a fix. You don't live for a fix. What does he say in Hazinu 32, 35? So for God will judge us, he loves 36. 35 is, vengeance is mine. Nakam, vengeance is mine, I will repay. Hashalem. So, vengeance is mine, I will repay, is God. And he's going to do it in his time, and his time won't be in your time. When it's his time, if you're in the right place, you're going to be like Abraham. When Abraham's looking at Sodom and Gomorrah, what's he doing?
He's interceding.
He's bargaining.
Yeah, bargaining.
Will you kill him if there's 10 guys in there? Don't ask for 9, Abraham. Okay, but I'm a 10. It goes from 50 down to 10. He's really trying to save the place. That's where vengeance is mine, I will repay, and that's where the righteous are in the day of vengeance. That was payback day, and they were under judgment. Boom. Abraham's bargaining to try and save them. When Jonah goes the other way, he says, I don't want to go to Nineveh because you're going to spare those guys. So forget it. I'm out. You understand? So Jonah has to get swallowed by a dagah, a whale, a whale fish. It's tough for him, see? Because he's in the wrong place, you understand? If you're in the right place, then in the day of vengeance, you're on the other side. You're looking for compassion. And it's going to be fast anyway. So when you're living for vengeance, you're out of whack with God's program. Number one, it's not your timing, it's his timing. Number two, he's good for it. So stop worrying about it and don't do his job. Number three, if you're sucked into that, you're on the wrong side of the equation. You're an enemy at a time when you should be an interceder. So either deal yourself out and move on, or learn how to have compassion. But if you sit there and wait for vengeance, you're playing the wrong game. You got to lose. It's a loser's game. Okay? You got to know when to fold up. When you feel vengeance, fold. Get out. You're in the wrong place. All right? Now here Nazareth is in the right place. They're getting hammered by the Romans. They're in the right place. Messiah is born in their midst. They're in the right place. They're Jews living under the covenant. And they're in synagogue. They're in the right place every way, except there's a big problem here. They don't recognize the Messiah. And on top of that, they want vengeance. Now you'd want vengeance too, with the Romans beating you up, killing your people, crucifying every Savior, and everything else that's going on.
Not only that, they're taking 3/4 of the pay.
Yeah, they're taking everything. This is bad. You're in downtown Egypt. You're back in the house of Paro, called the Romans. And they're idolaters, and they're making you idolaters. They're trying to hang eagles in God's temple. They're doing everything terrible. There's only one thing you got to realize. We're living the covenant. We made the choices. And the sins of the fathers, we brought it down on ourselves. Mm-hmm. When you're born in diaspora, it's the sins of the fathers. You say, well, wait a minute, my dad was a good guy, and so was his dad, and so was his dad, and so was his dad. How come you're born in exile? Well, we got chased out by the Russians. Yeah, and then before that by the Germans. Yeah, and before that by the Poles. And before that by everybody. Well, if you read, it says, covenant, you get chased from nation to nation. That's because you've been treating God lightly, so he's treating you lightly, so then everybody's chasing you around. But if you didn't treat God lightly, you wouldn't be in this fix. And because you learned how to treat God lightly from your parents, you keep perpetuating the whole reality. And you're responsible. You're the creator of this problem. And it's sins of the fathers. And now you're the fathers, as soon as you have a kid. And you're going to carry on with the same light attitude of your 5% religion, and we're going to live the way our fathers lived, and you're going to get the same result in the covenant. A lack of fruitfulness, a lack of blessing, and with it, more of the same. So how do you reverse this? Well, we'll answer that in a minute. We're going to go back now. We're in downtown Nazareth. The Romans are there. It's bad news for the Jews. Except the Messiah is here. And he's just proclaimed something. What has he proclaimed?
The year of the Lord's favor.
The year of the Lord's favor. Now this is out of nowhere. What happened? God sent the Goel, the Redeemer. And it's like, our relatives are too poor to redeem us. And here comes the national Redeemer. He's the guy. And he proclaims it. And we know what he's quoting from. We handed him the script. He opened it up to where it was. That's the Haftorah reading for the day. He's in the synagogue and he's reading the portion. He's opened up the portion. And it's not any portion. If you look right now, Kitavo, we read Isaiah 60. And if you read Nitzavim, we read Isaiah 61 verse 10. 61 verses 1 through 10, it's a whole. Into portions, it's not read right now. Mm-hmm. Now, if he walked in and it was Nitzavim, which means you're standing here on the verge of going into the promised land, he could have been given 61:10 and he could have looked back and started reading at 61:1. And said, this is fulfilled in your hearing. Because I'll tell you something, he stops mid-verse. Mm-hmm. That's not a reading. To stop mid-verse. He stopped mid-verse. That's a mind-blower. That's what that is. You get the reading. It's got a place where it begins. It's got verses. You don't stop mid-verse. He stopped mid-verse. Mm-hmm. That's got to get everybody's attention. So, you've read 61, and we're going to do it one more time, just verse 1 and 2, and then we're going to go back to Luke. We're ready for it.
The Spirit of the Lord God is upon me because the Lord has anointed me. He has sent me to bring good news to the humble, to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to captives, and to release those in prison, to proclaim a year of the Lord's favor, and a day of vengeance of our God, to comfort all who mourn.
Now they know that he's proclaiming salvation as the divinely anointed Messiah. They know that when he says he's appointed me, that that's Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, God the Father's appointed me to release the people shattered in fortune, the people broken in spirit. And they're hearing this. And then it's going to be the day of vengeance. And they know that the Messiah in the day of vengeance is going to beat the holy hell.
But he doesn't read the
every single nation. And when he does, they're all going to bow, and every knee will bow, and every tongue will confess that Yeshua HaMashiach is Lord. That's what they're looking for. And the Messiah does that. And in Jewish, you believe by the deeds. If he brings peace, then he's got to beat the holy hell out of every nation so there's peace. If he doesn't beat the holy hell out of the nations, there won't be peace. No peace until Messiah, and no Messiah until everybody gets hammered. And everybody got to get hammered, or every knee will not bow, and every tongue will not confess that Yeshua is the Messiah to the glory of Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, God the Father. And he knows it. Everybody knows it. And what is the Messiah expected to do? Why is he the son of David? What did David do?
Fight.
Mm-hmm. Boom! Israel. Okay, you come through here, you pay tolls. We own this whole strip here. We got a monopoly now on all commerce routes and the international highways trading Asia, Africa, and Europe. You come through here, and when you come through here, you pay the toll. Solomon sits over the toll booth, he collects fortune. David comes in there, beats everybody up, grabs the whole thing and says, I'm the king of Israel. And everybody goes, boy, that's he's the son of Judah. That guy's the king of Judah. Man, and his son at the end of the dynasty will do greater things than him. That's going to be the Messiah. And David's the first guy. He paid the price. He owns the tables. Everybody got to get rich around here. Yep. So everybody knows when the Messiah comes back, you're going to pay your dues. And every knee will confess, every knee will bow. And they don't bow until you beat them up. Hazinu, 32, right? Verse 43. We'll read that, and then we're going to go read what Yeshua read and said. Because they know Hazinu. They know what Nakam is talking about. Vengeance. So read 42 and 43. We'll get both verses there. And you know, it's really longer, but this is good enough.
I will make my arrows drunk with blood. My sword shall devour flesh. Blood of slain and captives. The heads of the enemy's princes.
And it's the Rosh Parot Oyev. The heads of the pharaohs, or the enemies. This is what the Messiah is going to beat up. Go ahead.
Rejoice with him, you heavens. Bow down all you gods before him. For he will avenge the blood of his sons and take vengeance on his adversaries. He will punish those who hate him and make expiation for his people's land.
And when he makes expiation, verse 43a, the very first line in it, says, rejoice what?
With him, you heavens.
You heavens. It starts out with the heavens. And the Masoretes, when they rewrite it, because they're afraid of idolatry creeping in here. But what's really going on is every nation's got its angel, and every angel is a principality over a nation, and it doesn't have anything to do with the fact that they're semi-deities and they're not in the same family or a genus species as a god of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. There aren't demigods that are like on God's level. It's like the gods of the nation are dust before him. Nations have gods, and the gods have some kind of power. The Canaanite fertility gods, they'll give you some rain over here. But it's short run, and it's not really power. Not when you're talking about Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. It's a whole different game. It's like one ant saying, well, that queen ant is in charge, and there's human beings walking around the planet. You say, well, a queen ant, yeah, that's a deity. Queen ant, yeah. Mm-hmm. When there's human beings on the planet, the queen ant, what's she going to do, bite somebody? Boy, that would be a shame. What happens if a queen ant bit your toenail? Rich?
Depends on the queen ant.
Yeah, if it was Isula, it would hurt. Isulas are bad. Mm-hmm. So you'd be hopping around. Then what would you do, huh?
Put a little ointment on it and go about my business.
Yeah, and then if you want to wipe them out, what would you do?
Step on them.
Yeah, and
or I'd probably take a magnifying glass.
See, now this is what they're up against, okay? Are you going to compare you with a queen ant? You see, this is the deal, right? Now, you get a picture here that's going on in Hazinu. Everybody knows what Nakam is about, vengeance. The Messiah is going to come, and when he's the Messiah, I mean the real guy, he's going to punch the lights out on the nations. And there isn't going to be any more competition in the planet on who's God. Every knee will bow, and every tongue will confess. And until that happens, there won't be peace. Until that happens, somebody's going to want to roll over Israel. Mm-hmm. Some superpower, some neighbor, some wannabe. You know what I mean? And they know this, so they're saying, the Messiah, you know, he's going to bring peace. And peace isn't just going to be a condition in your heart. It's going to be everybody knows. When King David knocked everybody off, everybody knew. Like, it was safe. You didn't worry about borders. The borders were where King David says they are. That's where the borders are. You want to conflict that? David will go out there, knock your lights out, and you won't be contesting it anymore. And you know that in advance, so you don't contest it now. Everybody got respect for the king. Now today, you know, people go, what Jesus do you believe in? Who's your God anyway? I'm into Hinduism. And so on. And they treat lightly who the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob is. They treat lightly who Yeshua is. Like he's a guy that turns the other cheek all the time and he won't punch your lights out. Treat him lightly. And then, you know, you're a soppy Christian. You know, you turn the other cheek all the time. I like guys like you because, you know, I slap you on the face and then, you know, you show me some more Christian love. So I like that because I slap you on the other side and take some more. And I see his weakness. And nobody's punching my lights out over it, see? So there's no respect. All right. Yeshua comes to town now. He's in Nazareth. Nazareth knows who the Romans are. And he reads the Torah. Now, you can pick up, go back to 4:18-19, and then you can read all the way to 21. Okay.
The Spirit of the Lord is on me because, you want me to start in 16?
Yeah.
Okay. He went to Nazareth, where he had been brought up, and on the Sabbath day he went into the synagogue, as was his custom. And he stood up to read. The scroll of the prophet Isaiah was handed to him. Unrolling it, he found the place where it is written, "The Spirit of the Lord is on me."
Let's stop. You know when we say unrolling it? You know when I take the Torah? Usually I'm supposed to have it on the portion. I spend my time looking for the portion because I like you guys to get involved once in a while on that. But I should, if I'm going to be on top of things, be right to the portion. When I open, unroll it, it's right there. So like right now, it's directly on the portion. It's on Bahar. Mm-hmm. So if I take it out right now and I unroll the scroll, it's right there. You understand? So when he unrolled the scroll, it's right on the portion reading. So go ahead.
The Spirit of the Lord is on me because he has anointed me to preach good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim freedom for the prisoners and recovery of sight for the blind, to release the oppressed, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. Then he rolled up the scroll, gave it back to the attendant, and sat down. The eyes of everyone in the synagogue were fastened on him.
Stop. Why were the eyes fastened on him?
Because he stopped in the middle of the... But I think also because he didn't read part of the actual Haftorah. I think because he was reading from a place that they didn't read from.
Yeah, could be.
Because it says here in verse 17, unrolling it, he found the place where right. It is written. So he was looking for right. A place.
Right, not only that. He's paraphrasing in there 58, verse 6. If you read Isaiah 58, verse 6 for a minute, just the one verse, you'll hear an echo of what he's interpolating into it.
Is not this the kind of fasting I have chosen, to loose the chains of injustice and untie the cords of the yoke, to set the oppressed free and break every yoke?
So unloose the chains is extra.
Yeah.
It's not in Isaiah.
Right.
Okay. But that's interpolated in there.
in this reading.
Is that in Isaiah, you mean? The actual
That's Bible? In Isaiah, but no, the part about the recovery of the sight is not in Isaiah. And that part.
And those prisoners come out, yeah. You know, they can't see.
Yeah.
That's from 58:6.
And he began by saying to them, "Today this scripture is fulfilled in your hearing." Shall I continue?
Yeah, now when he says it's fulfilled, what does that mean?
Came to life.
It's operating now, guys.
It's an active principle now.
Yeah, it's alive and well. It's here. More. Right, and it's in your eyes. You just saw it in your ears. You just heard it for yourself now.
So if I'm in the synagogue, I'm looking at him and I'm going, who is this person now?
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right, David. That's exactly right. And that's what Nazareth's doing, and you'll hear what they say about it. Now here comes the reading.
All spoke well of him and were amazed at the gracious words that came from his lips. Isn't this Joseph's son? They asked. Jesus said to them, surely you will quote this proverb to me. Physician, heal yourself. Do here in your hometown what we have heard that you did in Capernaum.
Now stop. See, he's back in Nazareth, but it's his last trip. He doesn't live there anymore. It's where he was brought up.
Right.
And now he's back. He's reading as was his custom, but not there. This is the first time he's read in this synagogue. That's why they're sitting there going, we never heard this guy preach before. Isn't this Joseph's son? How's he getting up and telling us, you know, stuff we never heard like this? And meanwhile, they're saying, he set up his base in Capernaum. Then we heard what he's doing in Capernaum. He's healing a bunch of people over there. So we expect him to be healing here. Put up or shut up. We believe the deeds. We'll judge you by your fruits. And you can't just talk. You can't just declare jubilee. You got to make it happen here. So?
I tell you the truth, he continued. No prophet is accepted in his hometown. I assure you that there were many widows in Israel in Elijah's time. When the sky was shut for 3.5 years and there was a severe famine throughout the land. Yet Elijah was not sent to any of them, but to a widow in Zarephath in the region of Sidon.
Well, stop. He was sent to who? Eliyahu was sent to
widow.
Who?
A widow.
A widow where?
Zarephath.
Yeah, Zarephath. And where is that?
Sidon.
Between Tyre and Sidon? That's
right.
Up in Lebanon?
Right.
You're talking about a Gentile woman.
Right.
Now he's sitting there saying, well, Yahweh healed a Gentile woman. You thick head. Now, how do you think they hear this?
Angry.
Would you be happy about this?
No.
You're a Jew and this is your hometown? You got a little hometown pride? And his answer is, well, you know, the best of the brightest, you know, during the hardest of times, heal the Gentiles.
Mm-hmm.
Well, maybe, you know, that was an exception. Now, who's the second witness? So he goes on.
And there were many in Israel with leprosy in the time of Elisha the prophet, yet not one of them was cleansed, only Naaman the Syrian.
Well, who's Naaman?
He's the general
of the army.
He doesn't want to defile himself.
So first you could argue, maybe a widow, okay?
Yeah.
Even if it's a Gentile. At least it's a widow, right? The poor defenseless, they can't do anything. But Naaman, who's that guy?
He's the second in command.
A Syrian bigwig general? What do the Syrian generals do to you?
An arrogant one.
Cut your head off.
They cut your head off. And Elijah's guy, he passes the mantle for a double portion to Elisha, and Elisha goes on heals who?
Naaman.
The big bruiser himself? Another Gentile on top of that Pharaoh type. Oh, good, good. Now, how are you going to feel now? You going to feel better? Where's the town pride now? Kfar Nahum is getting, you know, Capernaum is getting all these guys healed. You're hearing about it. And now he's in town. He's reading the Torah scroll. And when you say, well, you're going to heal somebody, his answer is Naaman. Naaman the Syrian general. That's who. Got to get healed in a place like this.
So what are you going to do now, David? You're good at this. You're sitting in the temple. You're trying to figure out what's going on, okay? It's totally flying over your head. And now he comes out with this outrageous comment.
I
should have been reading verse 2, and he won't do it.
Somebody probably stood up and yelled at him and said, why do you talk like this here?
But that was the kindest thing.
They do a little bit more than that.
Here's what they do.
These are Israelis we're talking about.
Yeah, you know, David, it's you in your best posture right now.
No, I was being kind, okay, but I give
them. They're not kind.
I have to give them a chance.
David, it's the way you felt in the garage.
All right, I'd have to give him one chance to like remit and say, okay, but I'm gonna go get past this here, and I'm gonna try and take my hometown and do the best I can do here.
But that's not what he's saying.
Yeah,
he's not saying that.
He's not gonna say that.
All eyes are on him. He stopped. He didn't read the vengeance is gonna come. He read a different line saying it's the year of favor, and after that, he knows they're waiting for him to heal people, and he's saying, yeah, the widow was a Gentile, and the Naaman, the Syrian, he's a Gentile. That's who they heal in places like this.
People are angry already because of Rome.
Well, yeah,
they walk around all day angry.
They got a chip on their shoulder because Rome's been beating the hell out of them, yeah.
Well, what they're hearing is that Yeshua is saying, you're not worthy.
Well, they're hearing plenty.
Yeah.
So go ahead, keep going now. You got it.
All the people in the synagogue were furious when they heard this. They got up, drove him out of the town, and took him to the brow of the hill on which the town was built in order to throw him down the cliff.
That's what they thought, David.
You're too nice.
They thought, we're going to invoke the ancient Jewish principle of the Lynch Law. Now, here's how the Lynch Law works. If you've seen somebody violating flagrantly the Torah, then execution on site without trial. Mm. All right, we see that in John 8:59, John 8:59, John 10:31, Acts 7:54-58 happened to Stephen. There's Acts 21:31-32. This is the Lynch Law. And why would they want to invoke the Lynch Law? Somebody read Deuteronomy 13, verse 5.
Stating things that he's not able to carry through.
If he's stating things he's not able to carry through, then he must be a if he's a false prophet, what does Deuteronomy 13:5 say? Don't listen to him and kill him. And obviously this is a time and place for it, because this guy says there's not going to be any verse 2.
But he won't
even heal anybody, and he's calling us Naaman the leper.
But he does show him a sign and a wonder.
Yeah, it's going to happen.
Real soon.
Yeah.
I think it's a leadership problem.
Well, in Capernaum it sure was. So keep going.
But he walked right through the crowd and went on his way.
Eporeveto. Here's your Greek word. Eporeveto.
What does that mean?
Say it. Eporeveto. 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 He just went on his way.
That means went on your way?
Yeah, he just went on his way.
How do you say it?
Eporeveto.
Eporeveto.
Eporeveto. Eporeveto. Eporeveto. He just went on his way. Luke 4, verse 30. Eporeveto. So the guy's out of there. He is out of there. Now, they've looked around there. You know, there's a Maronite convent in the southwest corner of town there in Nazareth. And it's, 40, 60 feet. There's another place in the southeast of town that's even taller. But mostly they think this was the southwest. And the way Nazareth was, it's sort of like a cave. Yeah, it is. It's like a cave, and then above,
this
is where the brow is. So it's like, well,
swirly.
It's on a hill, like with swirly roads around it.
Yeah, but it's down, and then you can go higher, and so it's like on the way out, on the way around, it would be like up. Yeah. So on the way out, they can throw you down from there.
And you don't want to be thrown down from there.
It's a drag. You take a dive if it was over there. So that's in the southwest corner. It's a jutting prominence, and that's why sometimes it's called here, like in the literature here, it's called the brow, jutting prominence. It's like, go put yourself on your eyebrow and take a dive. So Nazareth would be the eyeball, and above the town would be the brow.
This is really a bad scene.
Well, town pride exploded in verse 28,
I mean, the heathen was healed by Elijah, the widow of Zarephath, and then, you know, Naaman the Syrian, you know, was healed by Elisha, another heathen. Yeah, and he's saying he's not going to heal that. He's not going to heal anybody in town here. And this is hometown, and he's healing guys down the street in a bigger town where Jesus wasn't even born. And I mean, you know,
the level of pride and no common sense.
People are going to call him the Nazareth no-shows. I mean, it's terrible what's happening. Yeah, that's right.
I mean, you know, you look at them wrong and they get insulted.
Well, they didn't like it, okay? So the Day of Vengeance, you know, it's supposed to be against those who hold the people of God in fetters. And the Romans are holding the people of God in fetters. And the Kinsman Redeemer is coming, and it's National Kinsman Redeemer Day. Now, you know, Romans 11, 25 to 27 addresses this. What's it say? You've got to read Romans 11, 25 to 27. Paul's out there. Now, I want you to know a secret. You know, it's a mystery, guys. The partial hardening has happened on Israel until the fullness of the Gentiles. Oh. And in this way, all Israel will be saved because the Redeemer will come forth from Zion. And this is my covenant with them when I take away their sins. My covenant when I take away their sins.
So obviously, Nazareth did not have their sins taken away yet.
No, and on top of that, he wasn't, you know, saying it's Kinsman Redeemer Day. It's saying it's Kinsman Redeemer Year. And Kinsman Redeemer Year means the year of the divine favor, but it doesn't mean judgment on the enemies. So he's not going to beat the hell out of the Romans. And gee, we hate that, don't we?
But they didn't know he wasn't apolitical.
They Well, I think there's some important things to be observed there. Let's read Romans 11, 25 to 27. Because I think what's important here is to realize that in God's timing, he's still giving the world time. He's still giving the pharaohs out there time when he sends the Messiah to turn the other cheek. And it's like, whoa. There's a 2,000-year hiatus going on here between the year of favor and the day of vengeance. Whoa. Yeah, that year's a long time and the day's a short time.
How many years?
The year. This is the year of favor. Yeah. And then when he says the prophet's without favor in his hometown, it's that same word again. Vectos, both times. Vectos is favor. So here's the year of divine favor, and the prophet's without favor in the hometown. And meanwhile, the day of vengeance postponed, not coming, cut off, and the Messiah cut off and no vengeance.
Jesus, how many people outside the town of Nazareth do you think this situation and what he had read heard about?
Everybody heard about it. It was
in the whole countryside thing.
Sure. You know, the biggest town around, the biggest town around isn't even mentioned in the scripture. It's like Yeshua, like it didn't exist. It's Roman town. It's where the it'd be like Washington, D.C. or something. It's Roman town. It's called Sepphoris. Sepphoris is a huge Roman place. Now, Jews, tough to get a temple there. You wouldn't get one there. This is a Roman, it's a huge marketplace. Everybody had to go to Sepphoris to... Everybody had to go to Sepphoris to trade. Yeshua probably was there as a carpenter. And yet he doesn't preach the gospel in Sepphoris.
Doesn't go there, yeah.
No, he's not going to the Romans, you see. And then there's nothing to do out there in Roman town. Go die out there. They're not interested in anything but bloodshed, power, the military, transportation lines, commerce, the economy, things like that. And you don't have Jews living there. It's a Roman town.
So reading something like
But Capernaum is a larger Jewish town down the street, but not immediately down the street. Immediately down the street is Sepphoris. He doesn't go to Sepphoris, and he's running a huge thing in his headquarters, probably in Capernaum. So he's in Capernaum, and there's a Jewish synagogue there. And he's gone wild over there, and he's healing people. Meanwhile, Nazareth, here's the problem. And now he's gone. This is the last time. Now he's out of Nazareth. So we're reading, let's read Romans 11. So I want you to get the idea that under the covenant, God has been, you know, slow measure for measure, and finally we get to a point when I think I made a compelling case that eventually you got to get the Kinsman Redeemer for the nation, and here it is, the Kinsman Redeemer coming. Now here's what Paul has to say about the Kinsman Redeemer.
For I do not want you, brethren, to be uninformed of this mystery, so that you will not be wise in your own estimation.
Now, who's he talking to?
The Jews.
He's talking to the
synagogue.
Yeah.
And who's in the synagogue?
Well, Jews and Gentiles.
It's a Roman synagogue.
Yeah.
And you want to know something?
There's Jews and Jews and Gentiles in there. You got unbelieving Jews as well as Messianic Jews as well as Gentiles.
Why would there be Gentiles in the synagogue?
Because there's nowhere to go.
That's where they. That's where they.
Are these Gentile believers?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. No Gentile unbelievers.
Okay. Are these Gentile believers?
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Okay. But it's a tough case to say that Rome, the Roman synagogue there. If you said to me, "Are there more Gentile believers than Jews?" I'd say, "No way." Mm. If you said to me, "Are there more Jewish believers than Jewish unbelievers?" I'd say, "Questionable."
This is mostly Jewish unbelievers.
Well, it's a combination. I don't know. I just want you to be open to the idea that we don't really know, you know.
We're saying they're Torah adherent, right?
Yes, for sure, that we're saying.
Okay.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay. That a partial hardening has happened to Israel until the fullness of the Gentiles has come in. And so all Israel will be saved, just as it is written. The deliverer will come.
Wait, the who?
Deliverer.
That's an important word.
Goel.
The Goel. That's the kinsman redeemer. Mm-hmm. Redemption comes from the Goel. This is the Goel. When we read the Amidah, Goel, Goel. When we're reading this, Geulat Olam, the redemption. When we're dealing with. So the deliverer is the guy that brings it. That's the Messiah. Okay, keep going.
The deliverer will come from Zion. He will remove ungodliness from Jacob.
So there's ungodliness in Jacob when he comes. It's not like we're all standing there saying, come back, come back. We're waiting. Maybe some are. But maybe not too many. Okay, go ahead.
This is my covenant with them when I take away their sins.
Okay, go on.
Okay. From the standpoint of the gospel, they are enemies for your sake.
Now, from the standpoint of the gospel, the standpoint of the good news that Yeshua rose from the dead, they're enemies. So he's writing to weak believers who aren't sure that Jesus rose from the dead, as well as to people that are like Messianic Jews, as well as to Gentiles who were brought into the commonwealth. And he's saying, enemies of the gospel are these Jews that got the wrong ideas, and what about it? Beloved? Yeah.
Okay. But from the standpoint of God's choice, they are beloved for the sake of the fathers.
Now wait, when you say beloved for the sake of the fathers, you know, that's the Amidah. When the Amidah comes, you open the Holy of Holies, you're standing on holy ground, you've worked your way through the synagogue. Normally, after we would say the Shema, before we would do the Torah study, there'd be an intervening part in the liturgy, which went on in Yeshua's day, too, and was institutionalized when the temple was lost, but was said prior to that time in the temple. And it would include, it said every day in the Shacharit, and it's called the Avot, prayer. It's the first of 18 prayers in the Shemona Esrei. These are the 18 benedictions. And they would say the 18 benedictions. And it's before there's a 19th benediction. Because it's...
Because there is no 19th benediction.
Right. There's no 19th benediction. So we're in the 18 benedictions. So we're in the 18 benedictions. And when we get to the Avot, which is the prayer for the fathers, we say... Eternal God, open my lips. That's Isaiah, you know. Seraphim, that my mouth may declare your praise. Baruch Ata Adonai, Eloheinu, Elohei Avoteinu, Elohei Abraham, Elohei Yitzchak, Elohei Yaakov. So that's the prayer to the fathers, God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Now you're standing here in the Holy of Holies. Ha'el ha'gadol ha'gibor v'ha'nora el elyon gomel chasadim tovim mekodei Yaakov zocher chasdei avot umevi goel who will send a goel livnei v'neichem to the children of their children l'ma'an shemo v'ahava for the sake of his name with love.
So that's always done when the ark is open. Is that correct?
Adonai, Magen Abraham. What's that?
Is that always done when the ark is open?
Yes, because if you don't open the ark, you're not talking to God. Right. And when the Holy Holies opens up, it's like, I'm a man of unclean lips, and then Isaiah gets bailed out.
I
and so do you.
I couldn't focus.
Right. So And this is in the standard liturgy. So, for example, if we go to morning services on Saturday morning, I'll teach you the Avot. That'll be part of the introduction to the 18.
So what's the relational
quote? On Shabbat, 3 and 3. There's 6 out of the 18 that are said. The other 12 are personal prayers that are said on the other days. Why? Because on Shabbat we don't pray personally. Why? Because we pray corporately. Why? Because we don't put personal concerns before God on Shabbat. Why? Because Shabbat, all our personal concerns are taken care of. It looks forward to that time when we're released. So we don't need to pray for that. The day is the sign that takes care of that. So on Shabbat, we think about bigger things like God, family, household, nation. We don't think about personal things. We don't burden ourselves with that. So
what about the sin in the temple?
Just blot it out.
In Romans 8.
That's power.
So how does this relate? Is he in the same place as the ark open and he's doing this?
Well, that was before. Once the ark is open, after I finish this, what happens? The Torah comes out. So right. I just skip this, and we go right to the Torah processional, and then we go right into the
Paul's
Torah.
Saying
that's
here,
the word of God speaking to us right out of the box.
Paul's saying here, are we saying that the ark has been opened already? Now the Torah's out.
It's more
saying this.
Well, we're saying the goel. We're back on the curses and saying when we get into so bad a place that we've sold ourselves back into bondage in Egypt, it's like God's got to send the goel because there's no way to get out of this anymore. We don't have any responsibility to redeem ourselves because we're all enslaved.
But these people in the synagogue aren't thinking like that.
Well, of course, right? Nobody today's thinking like that either. Nobody ever thinks like this. This is a 2,000, 4,000 year time horizon. And God has measured it out over 4,000 years.
So this is a continuing
I'm just giving you the
problem.
Torah. Well, today we're dealing with Bihar. And in Bihar, Moses is on top of the mountain and he's telling us about this stuff. So I'm going back 3,500 years on the reading. And then I'm conflating with it the New Covenant equivalent when Yeshua came, and I'm putting it into the span of the curses being played out for 3,500 years till we got it, 1,500 years until the Romans and Yeshua came. But then, you know, in the present, it would continue with the Jews that are in Russia and Ethiopia and other things. And with us here, it's like we're on the other side of that right now. We're in the middle of temporary blessing.
So would you say that Paul is addressing covenant relationship here in
Absolutely. Romans 8? Absolutely.
And do you think the people in that synagogue are understanding that?
Messiah is, Nazareth is, yes. And when Paul comes along in Rome, and he's writing to the Romans, again, yes, he says, this is a mystery, let me tell you what it means. I'm telling you what's going to play out here.
What does he
and
say
this
about
is after Jesus
again?
Came.
What does he say about the deliverer?
Yeah, we're going to read it. Go ahead, Jim.
Again? Okay.
Yeah, well, just where it says to go out. Pick
okay.
up the deliverer.
The deliverer will come from Zion. He will remove ungodliness from Jacob. This is my covenant with them when I take away their sins.
And keep going.
From the standpoint of the gospel, they are enemies for your sake. But from the standpoint of God's choice, they are beloved for the sake of the fathers.
And that's where I gave you the avot. They're beloved. Leman Shemo Be'ahava, on account of his name in love, and this is for the fathers. This is the Abode prayer. Blessed are you, Lord our God, King of the universe, you know, God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, who will send a Goel as a redeemer to their children's children. That's down the generations. It's a covenant promise that Abraham never saw because he never even saw the 12 tribes of Israel. Will send a redeemer to their children's children for his name's sake with love. So he's saying they're enemies of the Redeemer who rose from the dead, but beloved on account of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, who promised to do what they pray for all the time, what they still pray for all the time. So they're beloved on account of the fathers because even though a partial hardening has happened to them, they're praying right, guys.
What about...
They're praying for the grace of God, and they're praying for God to fulfill His promises. And meanwhile, He's fulfilling them, and they're killing His Son. But that doesn't stop anything from going forward.
So, when Paul's saying that in Romans, is he talking about the Jews as a nation?
Yes.
Because
all
as individuals...
Israel. All Israel. Corporate.
But what about, like, when Jesus said that if... He could raise up sons of Israel from the ground and from the rocks. So isn't that saying
he can, but
from individuals?
Yeah, but he's got a promise. He's got an oath to Abraham. He can, but he's not going to break his oath to Abraham.
I understand that as for the nation, but I'm saying, how do you reconcile? Because it seems to me like Jesus was saying, it's nothing. I can raise up people So it's like, in a different context. Don't rely on that for yourself.
Well, that's right. That's always true for individuals.
Okay.
But that doesn't deny that God's reaching out to corporate mankind,
right,
or that God has a corporate witness to corporate mankind, which includes this nation that he raised up ex nihilo out of Abraham, that
right,
he swore on covenant oath that he was going to do everything that he's done all the way to today, including showing such incredible patience in Measure for Measure, that when he takes us down the road of going back to Egypt, it's like with every benefit in the world. I mean, right now we're in the United States, spread to the four corners of the earth, never had higher blessings while we got cursings playing on Ethiopia and Russia and Israel, everywhere. And meanwhile, never had it so good. It's a tale of two cities. And why? Because he's blessing when he blesses the world and he blesses us more. And he's cursing when he curses the world and curses us more. And under the covenant, we're going through all the motions, including after the Jubilee and getting regathered back to the nation even. We're still, you know, selling ourselves into bondage.
So wait a minute. So we're beloved right here tonight because of the Father.
Absolutely.
And
blessing to the thousand generations.
And we get more curses when the curses come down.
Absolutely.
And we get more blessings when the blessings come down.
Absolutely. And it's a one-way program because he curses the third or fourth generation.
Why?
Look at what happens. Curses to the third or fourth generation, or well, curses to a thousand generations.
But if we're doing,
so it's loaded. The deck is loaded. Going which way?
But
blessings.
Okay, yeah.
Okay.
But in Bihar, there's 21, at least seven times seven, it's 21 curses already he's got going.
Oh, yeah, at least. That's huge. And they pile them up even more in Deuteronomy.
So how does that, why do we have to have more curses? You know? And why doesn't the unbeliever have... What? They believe something. They just believe the wrong.
Kohanim v'goy v'dosh.
That isn't the problem. What if the Kohan is doing the right thing?
Yeah, then you never have to worry about any of the curses.
Exactly.
You don't have to worry about any of the curses because you're not walking that path.
Right.
You see,
how do I know? I don't know that.
You don't know that because you're walking the other path.
I could be ignorant.
If the hornets are chasing your enemies away, you're walking the right path.
Yeah, it's stuff you never need.
Yeah,
when we were in the Garden of Eden, we didn't have to learn what it was to wear clothes. Okay? We never had to go that route. But we went. Same thing with the curses. We never have to go that route. We can go the route of blessing, we can go the route of obedience. We never have to learn any of the curses. The problem is, you know, we do both, and so we get both. And Deuteronomy 30 finally culminates after all these things come upon you, the blessings, all of them, and the cursings, all of them. I'll redeem you and get you back in the land anyway. I'll return you, is what it is, to the land. And that's happened. So after Treblinka, hello, we're back in the land. Mm-hmm. And Treblinka, you know, up to a third, the worst. Nobody ever had that happen. It doesn't matter. After that, you're in the land. And then what? You think it'd be a wake-up call for us? Nobody has any clue that God's involved in that. Where is God? He turned his face. Well, he can't do that. What do you mean? He said he would do that, and how's he know? I steer off on him. You know, I'll be so revolted by your idolatry, I'll hide my face from that. We'll see what will be your hereafter. So he hides for a while. He said he'd do it in Isaiah. He said he'd do it in Hazino. He did it. Treblinka comes. Then we're back in the land. So what happens after that? We're walking around with our usual set of hang-ups. Where was God? He wasn't there. He wasn't there because he turned his face. He said he would turn his face. We can't get past it. So we got a lot of guys that are like atheistic because of that. Yeah.
Walking around
atheistic.
No problem.
And it's like, well, read the Torah, curses, and it's in there. He promised it 3,500 years ago if we took a set of choices. We took the choices. It was measured, guys. Only a third. Not everybody. We're back in the land. Get it straight.
Well,
what does that mean?
According to the atheists, the Bible is not a reliable source.
Of course.
So what's the point of reading it?
That's right. And, you know, if there's another nuclear war and you knock out a third, and I say, well, Revelation said they would do that, you'd say, that's another coincidence. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about it right now. And then later on, they'll say, nobody talked about that. They'll say, well, it was on the Internet. Feinberg said it a few times. Yeah, who heard Feinberg? I mean, come on. He's a rock under a cave somewhere. I mean, come on. Why didn't they say it somewhere, you know, like on NBC News?
They actually did.
That would have been okay, right?
They actually did. Well, no, not you, there was a program yesterday or the day before. They were interviewing some people about what, I mean, when's the rapture going to happen and blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
All that stuff. And yeah. That it's, that our time is the time that it can happen because, like it says, that there's the two witnesses that are going to die, that everybody's going to hear about it immediately, and it's like, until the time of, you know, the internet and all of that, they couldn't hear it all at once, yeah. Everybody at once, and I don't know.
Yeah, there's all kinds of
stuff. Yeah.
If I see somebody dead on the streets, unburied for 3 days in Jerusalem, I'll take note of that. That would be a tough call. Leave somebody dead on the streets in Jerusalem for 3 days. I have a hard time believing that.
Especially with the Orthodox there.
I mean, even if there was radioactivity sitting there, you'd get them out.
Yeah, three hours. I'd like to
say, 3 hours.
Like to say, but right. 3 hours even.
So, I mean, when you're looking at it, it's like, that's a tall order even to pull that off. But we'll see what happens. So, okay, here we are then. Their enemies, the gospel, Paul is saying, but beloved on account of the fathers, because
of the covenant.
Because of the covenant. Mm-hmm. And because God swore on oath to Abraham, this is what would happen. Okay, so it's all playing out right before our eyes. Now, big picture, summary here. Yeshua goes into Nazareth and he reads. He takes the scroll that they hand to him and reads from some place near on the designated portion. The fact that they had any portions at all, it's formative. The fact that they had portions from the Haftorah, it meant really they already had read the Torah and commented on it. We don't know who did that. They just, boom. And not only that, he doesn't tell the whole teaching. It's a sentence here, and a conclusion, and then another sentence, what he says in a follow-up. When he sits down, though, he's giving a drash based on the reading that he stood for. And all eyes are upon him. And they're fastened on him because, number one, he's new in the place for teaching. Number two, he's reading, he stops in the middle of a verse, and they know they want to hear that verse if he's going to read the verse before that. On top of that, he's in their face over, saying, you're looking for, you know, vengeance, and you're not going to get signs and wonders here. You're not going to get healing here, even though it's the year of divine favor. Because places like this are a backwater disaster that are right up there with what happened when Naaman was around, and before that, when the widow of Zarephath was around, and even though the best and the brightest, like Elisha and Eliyahu, were walking the planet, they were healing a Gentile here, a Gentile there, and you guys are in this boat where you wake up. That's the reality you're going to get. And so they said, we said, prophets without honor in the hometown, we couldn't agree with that one more. We're going to run you right off the brow, out of hill. And that was it. He left. He doesn't go back to Nazareth anymore after that. Believe me, he's not welcome in the city. And he's not going to go back there and do it again. So he's done with Nazareth after he kicks the dust off the sandals. Now, here he is, the kinsman redeemer. And I've laid a gargantuan case for why the kinsman redeemer would be born when he is. That God waits to send the kinsman redeemer, because up until that time, we're responsible for the kinsman redeemer. We're responsible on a nuclear level. Person to person, and then family to family, and then clan to clan. And now, when the whole nation's in the sink with the Romans, and they're in our face, and we got a foreign gods all there, and we're serving foreigners and foreign gods, and they're richer than we are, the Romans are, and we're all poor, and those guys are making us serve them at their temple feasts, and at their Sunday emperor days, and they're consecrating things to Zeus and Jupiter or whatever. We're running around doing all this stuff. If we got a big job in Rome, we're in there, standing there, doing the invocation to Jupiter. And then we go back to the temple, you know? And we got all this in our face. And the Romans are coming in there and they're trying to hang eagles in the temple. And we barely can keep them from doing that. So face it, you know, we believe in honoring the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And we die if they try to put an eagle in the temple. And we're Torah observant, but we got a few things off. And don't kid yourself, this age, with 5% religion, there are fundamentalist places too. It's still way off. And why is it off? Well, look what God does. God, with his gargantuan viewpoint, I mean, he really cares about the poor, the disenfranchised. He really believes in servant leadership. He really believes in exalting the humble. We don't have any of those ethics running anywhere in our organized religious systems. And Yeshua's hanging out with all the wrong people.
And today, if he were doing that, it would be the same number on us. I'm talking about organized religion. I'm talking about a blanket indictment at the corporate level. Not your individual little places with caves and your few here or there. I'm talking about the norms and the institutions. I'm saying we're not sufficiently different from Rome.
Mm-hmm.
We're really not that different. You know, we're a little more sophisticated because we don't hang Jupiter around. Instead, we say, you know, Simon and Garfunkel, you know, the neon lights. You know, we're going to live in our own life 90-95% because of the thrills are elsewhere than just whatever we think old-time religion is or something. When you look where the heart is invested, it's like everybody's got things that in their inner circle compete with being godly. All of us. And it's permeated the society. So we don't know right from wrong in obvious things. A lot of obvious things. We don't know right from wrong. We don't even know if it's right to invade Iraq or not. I mean, it's not a clear question. Some people, you know, it's the right thing to do, and other people, it's the wrong thing for the same kind of reasons. One, you're starting a circle of violence. The other, no, we're trying to give them, you know, freedom. Well, you can't impose it. Well, if you don't impose it, they're not going to change. Well, you can't change it. And you're using combat to try to force a change. And if we can't even get clear on that, if there's so many other things we can't be clear on, then it's not clear to us what right from wrong is. And when they were living in their days, they were ready in Nazareth to lynch Yeshua because it's like he just said that he's proclaiming you're a divine favor while he's not doing anything about it. He's setting himself up like to be the anointed of God himself while he's not going to take God's vengeance on the Gentile nations. So you had guys that would be wiped out over that. You had other guys would be wiped out over town pride. What do you mean you're not going to heal people from here? And those guys would want to kill them for other reasons, right? The other side of the lynch law, you know? We're the law. We make the rules. And you don't tell us what you're going to do and what you're not going to do. Well, he went his way. Town pride explodes and he went his way. But it sets the whole context for the rest of his ministry, which he's going to be rejected by his people, us. He's going to wander from town to town. He's not going to be recognized as the Son of God. He's not going to do the things that are expected of the Messiah. And that's going to cause people's already overtaxed realities to collapse. And then they're going to do crazy things, whether it's try to kill him or revolt against the Romans without him or anything else. And we're not open to doing it God's way. Now the irony is this. If God came back today, I guarantee you that the kind of patience he would ask for us from us today, we wouldn't be in a position right now to progress much further than they were. That's how everybody gets caught. Because God has a more creative way. It requires a little bit more from us than we're willing to invest. And it starts with the fact that we're 5% religious guys. If we get up to 8 or 10%, you know, we got more of a chance. If we were up to 40, 50%, we'd have more of a chance of hearing what he's doing and of going with the program. So, what does it really mean for us? Well, in a country like America, which is affluent, it means we're probably going to be a little overweight. It means we're probably going to be vested in a lifestyle that's associated with that. And what does that mean? We're going to be corrupted a little bit here and there by living here. When God says, remember, I give you the power to make wealth, he says that in Deuteronomy 8:8. He's talking about the idea, and when he gets into Hazina, he talks about Yeshua, little straight one, grew fat and kicked. It's like he gives us prosperity, and what do we do with it? We abuse it. Now, we want him to give us prosperity, but when he gives us prosperity, we're addicts. It isn't just alcohol. It's everything. We're addicts with food, we're addicts with lifestyle, we're addicts with all the things we do. Now, if we at least recognize that, that should humble us to a point where we should be able to like this. Especially if we understand that if we start getting mad or angry when somebody's attacking our sacred cows, then we're just like these guys in nature. And we need to have enough perspective to understand that when God is doing it his way, when he did it back here this way, he sent this guy to comfort us. But because we had built up expectations about what kind of comfort we wanted, it's like, we're still going to be oppressed and every knee's not going to bow and the Romans, he's not going to throw the Roman yoke off. How can the Messiah come and not throw off the Roman yoke? Today, if the Messiah came back and he didn't throw off the yoke of the nations, who would follow him? Today, if he came back and called us all to just live a humble, insignificant life under the status quo, and we get used to being enslaved by the systems that enslave us, but to do so in a way, would we call him a son? Well, that's the conclusion. I want to say that God has been merciful. He's been slow to anger. And when he doesn't declare vengeance on the enemies, it means that he allows more time, 2,000 years more time, for everybody on every side of the fence to wake up. And what we know is that means it allows oppression to continue. We say, well, the oppressors don't change. And what does Hazinu tell us? They not only don't change, they're going to beat us to a pulp. And after they beat us to a pulp, we're going to be humble enough to appreciate.
But if he gives people, like you just said, he gave us 2,000 years
right.
to wake up.
Right.
Well, and at the same breath, you says the oppressors won't change. Well, he gives them the opportunity to wake up as well.
Absolutely.
So we should give them the opportunity too.
I think the United States is the most benevolent dictator of any dictator that's ever been on the face of the planet. Now, am I biased?
Probably.
See? Because I'm an American.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm talking about corrupt systems. I believe it. Why do I believe that? I don't see us, you know, bombing everybody out of existence when we come. I don't see us going after, you know, with force everybody in the world. I don't see us grabbing, you know, willy-nilly whatever we can get our hands on. I see us patiently working through world systems, getting insulted by the UN, committing troops to places like Korea to keep from other wars, in Europe, or even though they spit in our face, to keep from other wars. I see us as peacekeepers. I see us as investing in foreign aid more than anybody else, sending out more missionaries than anybody else. I see us as, you know, unbelievably wealthy, but at least sharing some of it, where the other guys, I don't see that happening. So I see us as benevolent. When the Romans came, they taxed. We give. I don't care if we don't give much. We give. We don't tax. For those kind of reasons, I say we're the most benevolent dictators that have ever been on the face of the planet. Now, in that case, I say there's where we've learned. And we learned by being a place that was a refuge. This was a free land because everybody was running away from tyrannies. And then we wrote a constitution where we're still barely a nation of laws instead of men. And our presidents are not kings. They got good enemies in Congress and in the judiciary, and there's a balance of power, and it keeps everybody in us, and that's worked pretty good for a couple hundred years. And everybody kills everybody off, and nobody gets a whole piece. And I really believe that democracy is the absolutely most inefficient of governments, but
The most inefficient?
The most inefficient.
Forever.
The most inefficient. You can't get nothing done in democracy. But that what's great about that, absolutely great about that, is bureaucracy. And why? Because in a dictatorship, everything goes in a certain direction in a hurry. And that the virtue of democracy is that because nobody can get anything done, nobody can move anything radically in one direction or another. So democracy is the worst form of government in the world, except for all the other forms of government. That's what I believe. You hear what I mean, Anna?
And the market.
It's process. The worst form of government, except for everything fascism, else. Totalitarianism, right. You know, down the line, but social democracy, anything.
But what's interesting is in a democracy, when there is a stalemate between the parties and the Congress, that's when the market is most efficient.
Yeah, the market loves it.
But I don't agree.
Those turkeys can't get anything done. Great. They won't spend any money. We're going to rock it. There goes the Dow. And then all the ministers get out and say, this is terrible. More prosperity. Meanwhile, the ties are up. It kills
But
them.
I don't agree.
Yeah, I understand.
It's actually a true
because I think
well,
a social democracy is much better.
Except they have nothing to give away.
I think the Republic died with Lincoln.
You know, I don't know about
show me a social democracy right now.
Sweden.
That's charitable.
Sweden.
Okay. And
what about Sweden?
What percentage have they given in foreign aid?
Didn't understand the question. They give what?
How much money as a percentage of their gross
in foreign aid
product, yeah, have they given in foreign aid?
I don't know.
Nothing. Not much.
Okay. Well, not as much as the United States.
Well,
they don't get involved as much as the United States.
Yeah, but the point is, they should be more giving. They should be given.
They give to their own citizens a lot more.
Well, they tax
what is
them.
That to give to? It's like feeding your own family.
Well, you need to feed your own family.
Yeah, but you
America
don't care.
Doesn't
don't
feed their own family.
But you don't care about your neighbor next door who may be starving, and you got a little extra, you know, and you could help that neighbor.
You know, even Sweden, they used to tax.
Yeah, but you give your neighbor, but you don't give your child.
No, you give your children, but you got a little left over.
Sweden used to give 60. Used to have 60% taxes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and they found that you know they were like indolent and going nowhere. And they dropped the taxes down.
A little, yeah.
Because they found out that what happens is everybody, once the state owns more money than they do, then everybody lives off the state. Mm-hmm. And once everybody lives off the state, they start working like their state employees.
So
and state employees don't
no
work
incentive.
Like private employees.
There's no incentive.
It's not true.
I'm saying why their state living peaked and then started down, and why they dropped back taxes. So I'm saying that that part of the experiment went down. Now, in the United States, we were moving in that direction, then we turned around and went the opposite way because we said, well, the only guys that are really working their buns off in the society, you know, are corporate, like our individual
entrepreneurs.
Those are the guys that are working.
Anna, you
and
know,
so we want to make it friendly.
People need a payoff in Sweden and some of the socialist countries in France. They're thinking about cutting the work, adding to the work week, because they're not producing.
Yeah.
You know, so they're saying. So the government's going like, well, there's too much lean time. These people taking too many vacations. We're not producing anything here.
So the trade-off is with communism.
You can't pay
even.
For it.
No,
everybody's
communism
equal.
But
that's the most pure of equality. Under communism.
Socialism. Communism is more totalitarian than
communism is elitist.
Yeah, but it keeps everybody.
So is socialism.
Exactly equal.
So
they might have one or two bosses, but everybody's equal.
Yeah.
Except them.
And I'm saying the more equal we are, the more equal we are because we've got nothing. And when everybody's
well,
got
socialism
nothing,
doesn't say you have nothing.
Well, socialism tries to have more. But
pure socialism.
Okay.
We can't, I mean, it's unattainable at this point. But
respect for
what
private
does this
property
have to do with what we're talking
okay,
about.
Suffers more. Nothing. But whatever. What it has to do with is the idea